Well, it's really great, as I was saying, to have Kyle here. For those of you who aren't sure who Kyle is, you'll find out a little bit more in his interview. He has 226 caps for Ireland. 54 of them were as captain. He has hit 3,616 runs, and he has taken 256 wickets. So he's got quite the record, and it's really great to have him at Hamilton Roads. So let's welcome him up here. Thanks, Kyle. Kyle, you've got some record, and we will look at your record a little later. Tell us a little about life growing up here in Northern Ireland.
Well, can I start by just thanking you for having me? The one stat you left out was that Johnny got me out twice in one over. Not that long
before. So he claims.
Not that long before I retired. Growing up, I grew up in North Belfast in Glengormley. Son of me and Bill, and younger brother of Neil, and from a pretty early age, as early as I can remember, Mum and Dad sent me along with our neighbours to Ballyduff Gospel Hall, the Sunday school there, where I met a lifelong friend, a guy by the name of Johnny Lowe, who I think has spoken here. Johnny Lowe and I became very, very good friends, and you know, that was where my Christian life began. Ballyduff Gospel Hall, I was saved at 13-year-old. Just before my cricket career kind of kicked into gear, and I think that's an important thing to say.
So, why did you end up as a cricketer? Were you rubbish at football and rugby and all those other things, Kyle? Or?
Well, yeah, pretty much. I think I played rugby at school right up until first 15, and I think the end of my rugby career came when I played in the varsity game for University of Ulster versus Queens, and Jeremy Davison turned up to play for us.
Right.
And, yeah, that was enough for me.
Did you realise that wasn't your sport?
Started to realise that my legs built like these stumps weren't really going to carry me through a rugby career. So, yeah, pretty much I wasn't that good at anything else. Right? And, yeah, cricket was in my family. My grandfather played at Sand Mills up in the northwest, and my uncle Robin played at Craiga and at Lisburn. Whilst my dad didn't play, he was a pretty keen observer of the game, and you know, we went everywhere all summer long. I went to watch a lot of cricket from home.
So how did your cricket career end up with your first Ireland call-up?
Well, really, it all started with a guy called John Solanke. I don't know if people have heard of John, who was our pro at Cliftonville, who was a remarkable man. And there were a number of us who went through the ranks. You know, we kind of first got picked up at Ulster schools at under 15, then also under 18s, and when I was quite young, at 16, I was picked for the Irish under 23 squad. So somebody must have seen something there, either that or my father was throwing his money about. But the bottom line was, at 16 year old, I was called up to go to Scotland with the Irish under 23s, and after a few years of persevering, I got a phone call to make my debut in 1986 against Wales at Rathmines in a 2-day game.
Great. And as your cricket career was progressing, you had said, you know, you had a faith at a young age. How did those two things go together in your early years, or did they go together, Kyle?
Well, the simple answer was that they didn't, in my head, more importantly than anything else. Having become a Christian at 13, all of a sudden then I started to get recognised, and you get picked into squads, Ulster under 15, you start to see your name in the newspapers, and people are starting to talk about you, and you're picked up into the Ireland under 17s, under 19s, and before you know, you start to maybe believe your own hype. And whether rightly or wrongly, I felt that I couldn't fit church and a Christian life in with a cricket career. I was playing in a fairly competitive bunch of boys at club level, and I know some people here in the audience will maybe know who I'm, but we were led to believe that to be successful in cricket and in sport, you had to be a certain type of person. Ruthless, determined, you know, sacrificing all else. You know, I talk now about the fact that I gave my life and soul to cricket. And I did, literally. And we were pretty unpleasant, I would say. No, we were good. And I don't want that to sound arrogant. Maybe it does. But you know, we were talented and we were very competitive amongst each other. And I think that's what probably pushed us on as quick as we did. And we all get into the Irish side in and around the same in at the same time. So bottom line was, during that journey from 13 to 19 to 21, you know, I got further and further and further away from church and from a relationship with God. And in many ways, I refer now to it as being a part-time Christian. I wanted God on my terms and when it suited me and when things weren't necessarily going my way. Struggling on the field of play, struggling with life around cricket. And it was generally because cricket was all I thought about. It was all I did. It was all I ate it, I slept it, I drank it, I played it. And it was my morning, noon and night. And basically when things started to go belly up, I started to go searching again.
Yeah.
Which, pretty selfish at that stage.
Yeah.
But thankfully, things took a turn for the better.
Yeah. So focusing on your cricket and Ireland cricket, during your career, cricket and Irish cricket was on the rise and you seemed to be doing quite well. And that probably climaxed at the 2007 Cricket World Cup. Tell us about how great a tournament that was in qualifying for the Super 8s.
Listen, we talk about it, pinch yourself moments, and for 10 years we had tried to qualify for World Cup, and we eventually did in Bangor at Your Pitchard Park. We beat Denmark to qualify in 2005. The big journey then was getting to the World Cup in 2007, and I was lucky enough to take a sabbatical from work. We trained full time for 6 months from sort of September through to, we went to the Caribbean. And we'd kind of booked until the end of the group stages with school.
You hadn't really high hopes of qualifying, had you, Kyle?
we had realistic hopes. We had targeted Zimbabwe. Zimbabwe were in our group along with the West Indies and Pakistan. And we kind of thought, look, Zimbabwe, we've beaten them before. They're a realistic beat for us to make our name at the World Cup. And truth be told, we were terrible. We played really poorly, myself included. You know, the whole situation, the whole thing got on top of us. And we were very lucky to scrape a draw. We tied the game, and I'll never forget Eddie Burrell, who was the coach at the time, basically saying, lads, you have one more chance. And he says, we're playing Pakistan on St. Patrick's Day, and if we win that, we qualify. And I think there were a few people looking around the room thinking, this guy's half mad, you know.
They were fourth in the world at that stage, so it was really a David against Goliath.
Well, I like to think it was like Linfield playing Brazil at football.
Who's who?
and simply because you'd a PE teacher, you had carpet salesmen, you had a farmer, you had a postman, you had a bunch of guys gathered up to play against the best in the world. You know, we had gone to watch the first game in the group, which was West Indies and Pakistan. We kind of watched it in the crowd just to get a feel for the thing. And lo and behold, we arrived at Sabina Park on St. Paddy's Day, and the pitch was green. I've never seen a greener wicket in all my days. Inzamam ul Haq, who was the Pakistan captain, he didn't like the look of it, and he went a bit pale, particularly when we won the toss and we asked them to bat first. And we kind of thought, you know, everything's in our favour here. It's St. Patrick's Day, for starters. Everybody in the West Indies wanted Ireland to win. They were all wearing green. And all of a sudden, we got a few early wickets, and the belief kind of to grow within the side. And you could see the panic setting in, because at the end of the day, cricket is a religion in Pakistan, and they carry the weight of the nation on their shoulders. And I think a few of us were quick to remind them of that when they were coming in and going out. But they genuinely panicked. You know, we bowled them out for 130, and all of a sudden it hit us in the change room. We were 130 runs away from qualifying for the World Cup, or the Super 8s of the World Cup, and becoming what we felt in our own head, national heroes anyway, which we didn't become. But then the rain came on. We got ahead of this Duckworth Lewis, and the rain came on. We thought, hey man, this is tremendous. We're not even going to have to chase the rest of these runs. And eventually we got back out, and it was a memorable and forgettable game for me, because Niall O'Brien got us to the finish line and then got out. And Andy White had just got out, and it was my turn to go in and be a hero. Haven't got a duck in the first game against Zimbabwe. And down I went and took guard. And It was a guy called Iftikhar Bolan, and he was quite handy. Took my guard, took a few deep breaths, and thought, today's your day. You know, we only needed about 15 to win. I thought, I'm going to be a hero here. One ball later, back up the steps I went. caught it slip. And it was a very nerve-wracking time, but thank goodness now we get over the line, and we qualify for the Super 8s, which was just an excuse for 4 more weeks away from school. Any teachers here from Grosvenor?
Sounds great. And so for the rest of it, you had games against the likes of England and a few others, and we won't ask how the results went. What was life during the World Cup off the pitch like, and as you came home as national heroes or wanting to be national heroes, what was the culture like off the pitch as well, Kai?
Listen, it was a trip of a lifetime. You know, from I was 13 or 12 or 11 as I started playing cricket, all I dreamt of was playing cricket. And then as I wanted to play for Ireland, that was it, really. Eddie Burrell had suggested we might qualify for World Cup. That was beyond our wildest dreams. So the experience itself was just everything that I had ever wanted. And we soaked it up. We were on Sky Sports every day. We did the crossbar challenge for Super Saturday. the crazy thing looking back on it now was that we beat Pakistan on St. Patrick's Day. All our supporters were staying in a place called Duchess Rios, which was 2 hours north of the island. The manager of the hotel invited us all up that evening, put everything on for us. It was a huge party. And like I say, the Irish team made full use of that. I think he kind of regretted that after a while. But the following morning, we woke up, went down for breakfast, and my wife and I took a wee stroll down the beach, the white sands, Jamaica, just idyllic. And we got to one of the beach bars. It was on the TV, just like that TV on the wall there. Bob Woolmer, the Pakistan coach, was found unconscious and critically ill in our hotel. In fact, on the floor above us. They talked about the Pakistani betting mafia because they'd lost so much money on, a result that nobody anticipated. They talked about it being a Pakistani player. They talked about it being murder. And then all of a sudden, we travelled down that evening again, and the hotel was crazy. And you went from being euphoric and being absolutely out of this world to being right back down and realising, boy's a dear, the end of the day, it's a game of cricket we've just played. And on the same trip, a guy called Bob Kerr, who was the president of Cricket Ireland, he died very suddenly up in Duchess Rios again. So the game that we played against the West Indies, we actually wore two black armbands. And it was a great leveller. It was great bringing it back down to earth with a bump. And it made you realise, you know what? There's more to life than cricket. And I think that is where God started to kick in with me.
Yes. So share how, after the World Cup in 07 and the real highlight of your career, what was going on with you inwardly, and what happened in those sort of year and a half following?
I think before we went to the World Cup, Lynn and I met a girl, I met my wife, Lynn, who was from Margaret Hill, and we started to go to church in St. John's, Kilcleany, Margaret Hill. From pretty much we started going seriously. We got married in church and we went weekly. So Neville, the rector, had been speaking a lot. So there'd been a lot going on in my mind prior to the World Cup. Touching on the great highs of the Caribbean and then the great lows of the Caribbean, both personally and as a collective, as a team. All of a sudden, I started to question, everything I'd ever wanted in life, I'd been given. Everything I'd ever wanted to experience in life, I'd achieved. We didn't win the World Cup, but it felt like we did. And when I come home, there's no question that God spoke to me regularly in church. It was a wee bit like, Matthew 16 and 26, there's no use gaining the whole world and forfeiting your soul. And I spoke about the fact that I gave my life and soul to cricket. It was all I did. It was all I thought about from morning, noon to night. Devoted myself to it. So as we started coming back, there were other tournaments, there were more matches. We went to Bangladesh in 2008. And it just hit me. Can't really put it into words. Very hard to describe. We were staying in the 5-star Sheraton Hotel in Dhaka. And it was about a 40-minute journey between the hotel and the ground. And we were on our way to a game to play Bangladesh. And as I had been, I was kind of crippled by fear in many ways, the fear of failure. And on the way to the ground, we stopped. And there was the poverty in Bangladesh was like nothing I had ever witnessed and ever seen. And there was a woman hit the window of my bus with a stick. And I just looked, and she looked me straight in the eye. And she was so poor. She had hardly a stitch of clothing on her. She was significantly disabled. And it was just a flash of lightning for me, in the sense that she was so poor. But really, whilst I had gained everything that I'd ever dreamt of, spiritually, I was as poor as she was. We went on, we lost that game in Bangladesh, and that night I spent a lot of time in my room on my own, and I just prayed, and I prayed that, you know, my goals in life weren't right. I wanted God as my centre. I wanted cricket to be important, don't get me wrong, but to be peripheral and to have everything that way inclined. And the amazing thing, we arrived home from Bangladesh and got in the car. I was driving up the M1 and Lynn rang me. She said, look, Neville was speaking on Sunday, and there's a Search Scriptures course starting in church, and I think you and me should go to it. Now, I hadn't spoken to Lynn. I hadn't mentioned anything to her. But I hung up the phone and thought, that's not a coincidence. So Lynn and I went to church regularly, twice a week, and on the Sunday, and the two of us got our life sorted out. We now live in a Christian home. We have a lovely wee boy called Matthew, and it's Matthew for a reason. He is a gift from God for us. And from there on in, my career not only progressed and my form got better, but just life got better in general, because it was no longer my centre anymore.
Yeah. And the following year, you hung up your bat, or you left Irish cricket. Some said you were crazy for leaving whenever you were in such good form, and you maybe had the World Cup in 2011 ahead of you. What drove that decision at that stage in your life?
Simply, God did, in a number of ways. I had Phil Simmons try to persuade me to not do it. I vividly remember a documentary I watched in Nairobi, believe it or not, when we were away on a trip, where they interviewed the Chapel Brothers from Australia, and they said the one piece of advice I'd give anybody was to retire when people are asking, why are you retiring, as opposed to, why are you not retiring?
Yeah.
And that was always with me. But there were a lot of things that happened in my life. My dad, and anyone who knows my dad, did everything for me. He followed me around the world. He gave me everything that I needed to succeed as a cricketer. He took ill with a form of cancer called multiple myeloma. And on that January, he was due to go in for a stem cell transplant, and I retired in December. Lynn and I wanted to start a family. I wasn't getting any younger, and the commitment of Irish cricket would have meant that you were away an awful lot. And there were career opportunities going to be imminent in school. So I prayed a lot about it, but the fundamental was, God told me to be with my dad. He was going to need me. And that was my decision made up. Mm-hmm. And it was easy. And people say, do you regret it? No, not one bit. Do I miss cricket? Yes. Do I miss internet? Do I miss the buzz? Yes. But the only thing that would have been me playing in India, which again would have been a great experience, would have just been my own pride to have been there for the sake of my own ego. And I just knew it wasn't the right thing for me, and it's turned out that way.
Yeah. And in the cricket world, in the last week, it has been a really tragic week. A lot of you will have heard, and for those of you who haven't, we have a short video here which will share just what has happened in the last week of international cricket. Thanks.
Philip Hughes was 25, taken from life in his prime. He died playing cricket. That has left a profound shock across an entire sport. It was Australia's cricket captain who spoke on behalf of the Hughes family.
Cricket was Philip's life, and we as a family shared that love of the game with him. We would like to thank all the medical and nursing staff at St Vincent's Hospital and Cricket New South Wales medical staff for their great efforts with Philip. We love you.
Philip Hughes had rare talent. Aged just 20, he made two centuries in the same test match, the youngest player ever to do that. His approach was to attack. If that left flaws in his technique, well, that in itself was endearing. In and out of the Australian side in recent years, he was still the Australian dream, a country boy who made it to the top.
The thought...
Kyle's somebody who has lived in the world of cricket for so long. How did you reflect on what has happened in the last week in world cricket?
It's very similar to what happened in the Irish camp in 2007. You know, there's a guy whose life was committed to cricket, and you see the profound effect all around the world, including in Ireland. You know, in school we'll be laying our bats out for Phil Hughes this week. But what it's brought home again is just the fragility of life and where priorities must be in life. And like I said, you know, we were heroes one day and fish and chip paper the next day. I found myself surrounded, and myself included, in a cricket team where you got 100 one day but you weren't happy. You wanted another 100 the next day. You got 5 wickets one day, you wanted 6 wickets the next day, and you were always thirsty for more. And you know, I still see that, and I suppose the nature of sport is that's it. Sports people drive themselves on that way. I just hope that maybe through all of this that people realise the fragility of life, and that cricket, whilst it's extremely important, is not the single most important thing.
Yeah.
I learnt that, and I later on in my career, I only wish that I'd realised that you can be a Christian sportsman and you can be successful in sport, but so long as your sport doesn't you know, engross you beyond you know your spiritual needs.
That's really helpful. And you said that cricket is what you were living for, and you realised the folly in this sense. What would you say to maybe some of the youth here who are hoping for a career in professional sport, or even to older folks who are maybe have thrown life and soul at their work or at something else? What would you say to them?
Tell you, it's something I still struggle with, if I'm being honest. Work as a school teacher just consumes you at times, and you've nearly got to take a step back. From my point of view, it's realizing what is truly important and what can't wait for another day. You know, we try to be salt and light in school. For far too long, I bluffed myself through cricket to say that, you know, I've been given a God-given talent here. It would be dreadful and sinful of me to waste that. But I was only really lying to myself. And in many ways, we look at other avenues in our life where you prioritise it beyond the healthy. And all I would say is, you know, since the day and hour I retired, the day and hour I committed myself to Christ and started to read my Bible on a daily basis, and God spoke to me, you know, my fear disappeared, my fear of failing in cricket disappeared, and the single biggest important thing to me was not whether or not I won or I lost. I still don't like losing, as you probably will testify, because I swear I didn't hit that still to this day. I still don't like losing. I still find it very difficult at times to get that balance right as a cricketer on a Saturday. That competitive nature is something that you've got to quell. But, you know, the bottom line was that whenever you sit back and think, the single biggest important thing for me in my life is Christ and how people view Christ through me. And if I play my cricket in the Warringstown, as it's only now at Warringstown, would they know it? He's a Christian.
Yeah.
Or do I let myself down? Do I get over competitive? Do you have that grace to go and see people when they need them? Do they know? And they do. And the most difficult thing for any youngsters here, for me as a 34-year-old, was going back into the changing room and trying to say to the guys, listen, life's different for me now. And I feared that. I thought the guys would, if you knew the makeup of the Irish team, Trent Johnson, Jeremy Bray, Regan West, we had a lot of, you know, big, aggressive, sort of intimidating characters in there, and I kind of thought, you know what, I'm going to be the butt of all their jokes, they're going to flip and persecute me here, and I'm going to be the biggest laugh in the changing room. Not once. And indeed, at one stage in Nairobi, I come in from dinner one evening to see Big Wesley reading the word for today, and it was interesting reaction to it. He threw it down and apologised. I'm sorry. And I kind of thought, please don't ever apologise. You pick it up and read it. And we had a lot of very good discussions, and people who know Regan West would probably think that's a bizarre thing. And I don't know where he is in his journey. I pray he's on his journey to faith as well, just as people around the world will be through Phil Hughes' incident today.
Kat, it was really great to have you here at Hamilton Road and to hear some of your life on and off the field. And if anyone has any questions for Kyle, he's around later. I'm sure he'll have at least one croissant in his hand from what I hear. So you'll be more than welcome. Whatever your question is, whether it's related to his faith or to his cricket, you'll be more than welcome. So let's have a round of applause for Kyle. It's good to have you. Thanks.
Thanks a lot.
I wonder, are you a curious sort of man or woman here? If you see something and if it says, do not open, are you the sort who will open it? If you see something like this here, sitting under the Christmas tree, which went up in our house this weekend, and it's not even December yet, are you curious as to what is it, and you sort of rattle it just to feel and to see what it is? You're all curious, thinking, what is in that there? Or are you the sort who, whenever you are driving along the road and you see a car accident and you're driving along at the limit, and you suddenly slow and slower and slower, and you sort of have a wee look around just to see what happened. I'm that sort of man. I love just to see what has happened, who hit who, and what the damage was. And what we're going to be looking at this evening is a man who was curious, and he was called Zacchaeus, and you've maybe heard a lot about him whenever you were younger. If you grew up in Sunday school, you may remember some of the story of Zacchaeus, and it's probably one of my favourite stories in the Bible. And for the rest of this evening, that's just what we're going to be looking at. And while he was curious, he was also on a search for true satisfaction, and that's what we're going to be looking at. So if you have your Bibles, it's in Luke chapter 19, and if you haven't, you can read along here on the slides. And here's what it says in Luke chapter 19. It says, Jesus entered Jericho and was passing through. A man was there by the name of Zacchaeus. He was a chief tax collector and was wealthy. He wanted to see who Jesus was, but being a short man, he could not because of the crowd. So he ran on ahead, climbed up a sycamore fig tree to see him, since Jesus was coming that way. Zacchaeus was a curious man. He wanted to know more about who this man Jesus was, who was passing through Jericho where Zacchaeus lived. Jesus was on his way to Jerusalem. It was the feast of the Passover, and everyone was making their way to Jerusalem, and so he wasn't walking alone. He had a huge crowd following him as well, walking along the roads with him. And Zacchaeus heard that Jesus was coming his way, and he wanted to find out just a little more about who Jesus was. However, he had a problem. He was a small man, and there was a big crowd. Some of you here, I'll not say who, maybe know what that feels like. Maybe you've went along to a concert or to the terraces at Ravenhill or an Irish League football or some local Irish cricket, although not really sure if anybody would. And you're standing there and in front of you walks four giant men and you think, oh no, can't see anything, I've just wasted that. Thankfully that's never happened to me. Not yet. So a large crowd is following Jesus, and you can just imagine the level of noise and hype that was walking along as well. Kids would have been running left and right. Everyone would have come out of the woodwork just to see and hear who this guy Jesus was and to see what would happen. It was sort of like if the royalty said, right, I'm coming to Northern Ireland and I'm going to walk along Hamelin Road. Everyone would line the streets and try to walk along with them. Everybody would want to, just to see a little bit more about who this Jesus was. Zacchaeus was short, so he couldn't get a good look at who at Jesus. So he ran on ahead, he climbed up a tree, and he thought, from up here, I will be able to see a little bit more about what all the fuss is. But what else do we know about this man's case? Is it just that he was short, or is there more to? Well, in what we have just read there, it says that he was a chief tax collector and he was wealthy. That's an understatement. He was mega rich. If they had had airplanes and helicopters, he would have had it all. I'm sure his yacht was amazing. And it wasn't wrong that he was a tax collector. However, in these days, they were all famous for collecting what they should have and then collecting a little extra for themselves. So they collected some for Caesar and then some for themselves, often crippling, hard-working Jewish people. And Zacchaeus wasn't just a tax collector, he was a chief tax collector. He had reached the very top of his career ladder. And other tax collectors would have had to give in Zacchaeus a certain amount of the money that they collected of others. So Zacchaeus probably had more money than he knew what to do with it, life. A little like Alan Sugar. He was small and he was loaded. So you can imagine how others may have felt towards Zacchaeus as a tax collector. He was rich. That's what we have read. He was powerful. Others had to give him what he asked for, and he could charge them whatever he wanted. And that also meant that he was hated by others. Nobody would have liked this man, Zacchaeus. Yes, he had lots of money, although he was greedy and selfish, and he would have kept it to himself. Can you imagine if you had to give another 10 or 20% of your earnings to somebody else, and if you saw them driving along in the flashy car and in all the gear, you probably wouldn't think, okay, it's lovely to see you having such a great life. He would have had no friends, and others around him would have hated him. And then we can also find out something else from his name as well. He is called Zacchaeus, which is actually a Jewish name. And here's what his name means. It is the righteous one, honorable, trustworthy, and innocent. Zacchaeus wasn't living up to what his name was. He was dishonorable, he was untrustworthy, and he was guilty. He was a chief tax collector for the Romans, robbing the Jewish so that he could get rich, robbing his own people. However, he ran on ahead, climbed a tree to get a closer look at who this man Jesus was. And Jesus' popularity is reaching its climax here. The Jewish people are thinking he's going to lead an earthly Jewish kingdom. They've all heard his amazing teaching throughout that region. They've heard of his many miracles as well. How in Luke chapter 18 he healed the blind man so that he could see again. In Luke chapter 17 he healed 10 lepers of their leprosy. And just a little earlier he had risen Lazarus from the dead just up the road. So word about Jesus was out. Everybody would have heard of his amazing miracles and his amazing teaching. And Zacchaeus wanted to see a little bit more for himself. So that's why he's up a tree. So let's see what happens as he's up that tree. Verse 5, and it should be on the screen here. When Jesus reached the spot, he looked up and said to him, "Zacchaeus, come down immediately. I must stay at your house today." So he came down at once and welcomed him gladly. Zacchaeus gets more than what he thought he would whenever he climbed that tree. Jesus, as he's walking along, looks up and says, "Zacchaeus." And he calls him out by name. And there's maybe a few reasons why Jesus knew his name. Maybe Zacchaeus was so famous in that area that everybody just knew who Zacchaeus was. Maybe as he was walking along the road and as the crowds all seen Zacchaeus running on ahead of them, all of them maybe said, "Look, there's Zacchaeus. Look at him running." Men didn't run in those days. And they certainly never climbed a tree. So maybe as the crowd around seen what was happening, Jesus overheard them calling him Zacchaeus. Or the third option, which I think is the right one, is that Jesus knew who Zacchaeus was using the fact that Jesus was God and that he knew these things. Jesus used his divine power to know who he was in the same way that he knew that the woman in the well had 5 husbands. Jesus says, "Zacchaeus!" And the amazing thing here is that while I may not know your name and while I may not know anything of your life at all, God knows your name. And he knows everything about you. The Bible says that he knit you together in your mother's womb. It says that he knows how many hairs are on your head. For some of you, it's a lot. For some, it's a lot less. It says that he knows the situation that you find yourself in this evening. The Bible actually says that God knows you better than you know yourself. And that's amazing. So whenever Jesus calls Zacchaeus out of the tree, it's reasonable that we assume that he knows the situation as well. He knows that Zacchaeus is rich, he is powerful, and that the Jewish people hate him. He knows that Zacchaeus has done wrong to others and done wrong to God. It's what the Bible calls sin. He knows that Zacchaeus is a dirty, rotten sinner. And yet look at what he says. Come down immediately. I must stay at your house. Zacchaeus had lived life his way rather than God's way. And Jesus here is offering him friendship. To go and stay at somebody's house is an offer of friendship. Jesus, the one that Zacchaeus wanted a closer look at, is actually going to have Jesus at his house to be his friend. Later on, in verses that we will look at, Jesus is described as the Son of Man, God in human flesh. He is the creator of the universe. He is the all-powerful one. He is the King of kings. He is the Lord of lords. And he comes and offers Zacchaeus his friendship. And the amazing thing for us here at Hamblin Road at the end of Free For All is that not only does Jesus know all about you, he's offering you his friendship. He's offering you forgiveness for all the wrong that you have done in your life. And he is able to do that as he's the one that went to the cross to pay the penalty for your sin and for my sin. And he is able to say, you no longer have to live that way in the fear of failure or the fear of what others think or carrying around that guilty conscience of what you've looked at and how you have acted. He says, I can take that so that you can go free. It's what Kyle shared earlier. It's what Joe shared here last week at Free For All. It's what Robin shared in the first week of Free For All. Knowing the forgiveness and friendship of Jesus Christ is amazing. Let's see what happens finally and thirdly. Zacchaeus was changed by Jesus. Verse 7 onwards. All the people saw this and began to mutter, he has gone to be the guest of a sinner. But Zacchaeus stood up and said to the Lord, look, Lord, here and now I give half of my possessions to the poor. If I have cheated anybody of anything, I will pay back four times the amount. Jesus said to him, today salvation has come to this house because this man too is the son of Abraham. For the son of man, that is Jesus, came to seek and to save that what was lost. See, Zacchaeus is a totally new man here in verse 8. He has given half of what he has away and he is willing to give four times what he has robbed anyone of. Here's somebody who is living for money and power. It's what drove his whole life. He wanted fame and fortune in Jericho. And yet he's willing just to give it away now. An amazing transformation. He goes above and beyond what is required of him in the law. Money and power once controlled him. But Jesus is now number one in his life. And he is free to give his money away. Zacchaeus didn't give his money away to get right with God. He gives it away because he has been made right with God. Notice what it says there at the end of those verses. Today salvation has come to this house. That word salvation means that he has been saved from the punishment that he should have had and saved into a relationship with God that would start on earth and then last for all of eternity. Zacchaeus had been saved from hell and saved to heaven. And the reality of that, he no longer worried about what this life offered. He was more worried about who he was before God. Zacchaeus was curious. He just wanted another look at Jesus. However, he got a call from Jesus and he was then dramatically changed by Jesus. Whenever Zacchaeus got that invitation, there was no way he was going to say, nah. I wonder Do you see yourself in the story of Zacchaeus? Are you curious about who Jesus is? Is that why you're here? Just wanting to find out a little bit more. Maybe you're here to hear what Kyle had to say. You're curious about what drives him on and off the field. Maybe you're curious and want to find out more. Maybe you're called. Maybe you can feel God calling your name here this evening. And he's saying, I'm here, you just need to accept. The offer of forgiveness is there. Reach out and grab it. Or maybe you have already been changed. Maybe for the last few weeks here at Free For All or earlier in the year, you have had a life-changing encounter with Jesus. Can I say, wherever you are, take a closer look. Look at the cross. Look at how it transformed Kyle's life, how it transformed Zacchaeus' life, how it transformed the life of your friend who asked you along here. And the call is there for you. John 3 says, whosoever believes in him, that call of life is for you this evening. Let's pray. Father, just thank you for this amazing story of Zacchaeus and how he was transformed. How your son called him out of a crowd and offered him friendship and forgiveness. And Father, I ask that you would help us to see that offer. As you cry out from the cross, I love you. Would you help us to rightly respond to you? We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.